This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for May 2013. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. On the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature readings from poets in the current issue.
This month, we'll hear from Jessica Greenbaum.
We did speak like that, as if from a book of Psalms.
Rick Barrett.
Landscapes mangled into sentences. One color red into rage.
And then we'll talk with Amiri Baraka about the Black Arts Movement and the backlash against it.
There's nothing wrong with you being black. It's just like there's nothing wrong with you being white. It's what you do with it that matters.
Also in this issue, we have poems by Jeffrey Brock, A. Stallings, and Kay Ryan, among several others. We usually start off these podcasts by talking about a couple of the poems in the issue, and we're going to do that, but we thought it might be better this month to focus on the winner of this year's Ruth Lilly Prize. It was Marie Ponceau. We have an entire portfolio featured in the magazine, and she's 93 years old and still writing wonderful poems, and it's about time that she got the recognition she deserves, right, Don?
Yes. The prize is administered by the Poetry Foundation, and it does go to an American poet whose lifetime accomplishments warrant extraordinary recognition, and Marie Ponceau's is a life of extraordinary accomplishment. She wrote most of her poems while raising seven children by herself, but it's not her life's circumstances, it's her life's work that we're talking about today. And Chris, you wrote an introduction to that portfolio in the issue, so for listeners who may not know her work, maybe you can give us a sense of what her poems are like and what you like about them.
You know, it's difficult to give a clear sense of what her work is like because it's so various. That's one of the things I especially love about it. But it's interesting that you mention the fact about raising seven children by herself. I immediately thought about this poem called About My Birthday. I'd like to assume from my April birthday I quickened the womb on the 4th of July. If you suffered as I a sternly fought tendency to endless dependency, you'd know why. It's a funny little epigrammatic, funny and yet acerbic,
yeah.
Right? There's some anger behind it.
You know, it's, I don't think going too far to say that what she does is kind of updates poetry with the strengths that someone as sharp an observer as Emily Dickinson set precedent for, so that in About My Birthday, it's a small poem that contains this kind of vastness. You know, if you suffered as I a sternly fought tendency to endless dependency, you'd know why. To me, that is Dickinsonian, but it's almost like if Dickinson had a family and lived in our time. Marie Ponceau is in the world.
That's a good point. It's not just this solitary existence, right? It's someone completely engaged with their life at every turn.
Yeah. It is summer under our butter bread, summer's hunger satisfied. And, you know, every word carries so much weight. And yet, it like a sort of a new, almost like a New England stone fence. All these words are just set so carefully next to each other that they prop each other up, and it seems like these are structures that will just last forever.
Well, there's another part to that poem that I love, where there's a playfulness. This poem is like a lot of her poems, is a poem in which sadness is veined with happiness, and happiness is veined with sadness, and you come out of the poem not quite sure which emotion you've been given completely, and that's the whole point. And there's a part of this that says, under of what I remember, we are both 20, and except with each other, underemployed. That's wonderful, right?
One of the poems that I really like, too, is Old Mama Saturday, which is connected to Saturday's child must work for a living. The whole poem is in quotation marks, and it starts off, I'm moving from Grief Street. Taxes are high here, though the mortgage is cheap. The house is well built with stuff to protect that mattered to me, the security. These things that I mind, you know, aren't mine. I mind minding them. They weigh on my mind.
Yeah.
That's superb.
Yeah. But then she also wonders about if she throws all these things out, what's going to happen? And she says, maybe it will empty me too emptily and keep me here asleep at sea under the gilt quilt under the yew tree. That's Y-O-U tree,
right.
Which is wonderful. It goes back to that sternly fought tendency to endless dependency, but it's playful and subversive.
It's also got a real tough realism in it. It's Blakean, too.
You know,
the yew tree, sort of like the poison tree or something.
Exactly.
There's something really strange and haunting about that.
Jessica Greenbaum has a poem in the May issue. Her latest book, The Two Yvonnes, was chosen by Paul Muldoon for Princeton's Series of Contemporary Poets.
Jessica Greenbaum lives in Brooklyn, which along with the rest of New York City and much of the eastern seaboard was pummeled by Sandy last fall.
When Hurricane Sandy came to Brooklyn, this is one way it looked in the little shared backyards.
As New Yorkers might remember, Hurricane Sandy was followed by a light snowstorm, which comes up in this poem. Here's Jessica Greenbaum reading The Storm-Struck Tree.
As the storm-struck oak leaned closer to the house, the remaining six-story half of the tree listing toward the glass box of the kitchen like someone in the first tilt of stumbling, the other half crashed into the neighbor's yards, a colossal diagonal for which we had no visual cue save for an antler dropped by a constellation. As the ragged half leaned nearer, the second storm of cloying snow began pulling on the shocked, still-looming splitting, and its branches dragged lower like ripped hems it was tripping over until they rustled on the roof under which I quickly made dinner, each noise a threat from a body under which we so recently said, "Thank goodness for our tree, how it has accompanied us all these years. Thank goodness for its recitation of the seasons out our windows and over the little lot of our yard. Thank goodness for the birdsong and squirrel games which keep us from living alone, and for its proffered shade, the crack of the bat resounding through September when its dime-sized acorns land on the tin awning next door. Have mercy on us, you, the massively beautiful, now ravaged and charged with destruction." We did speak like that, as if from a book of Psalms, because it took up the sky.
That's a wonderfully surprising ending.
Yeah.
She turns it into a kind of prayer, I mean, deliberately, as if from a book of Psalms. I also am struck by the ambiguity of that word, it. We did speak like that, as if from a book of Psalms, because it took up the sky. So obviously the tree took up the sky, but also there is a momentary suggestion that the speech took up the sky. Mm. We spoke like that because it took up the sky. It lifted the sky.
Well, in the storm lifted up the sky as well. The poem is so vivid, especially when you think how relatively little time has passed from that event till now. It surprises me that someone's able to come up with a good poem on such short notice.
Yeah, well, part of the way she does it is by relying on old forms. I mean, this poem is in free verse, but it relies on the rhythmical, repetitive tradition of Hebraic poetry.
Yeah, the cadences.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and it is a kind of supplication to an angry God in a way.
Yeah.
Just the majesty and the shock of what's happening is humbling, and the poem expresses that.
Have mercy on us, you, the massively beautiful, now ravaged and charged with destruction.
In all of the conflicted language of the Psalms, you get both the anger and the pity, the tenderness of those poems.
Yes, and the music and the kind of disjunction.
We have two poems this month from Rick Barrett, who teaches at Pacific Lutheran University in Washington and also at Warren Wilson College.
He's published two books and just finished his third collection. And the first poem we're going to hear is the last one that he wrote for that book.
It's called TARP. And by TARP, he doesn't mean the Troubled Asset Relief Program. He means something potentially even more boring.
The blue thing that you see on people's, roofs when there's a leak. And I had seen black ones in Italy, which they would use to catch olives during harvest time. Orange ones, yes. TARP.
As we all know, a poem can be about anything, but TARP, really?
Well, I mean, TARP is such a ridiculous, casual, everyday kind of thing that it is not the stuff of poetry. And so the joke to myself was, how can you actually write a poem about something that is as unpoetic as you can get. So,
here's Rick Barrett reading TARP.
I have seen the black sheets laid out like carpets under the trees, catching the rain of olives as they fell. Also the cerulean brightness of the one covering the bad roof of a neighbor's shed. The color, the only color, inside the winter's weeks. Another one took the shape of the pile of bricks underneath. Another flew off the back of a truck, black as a piano, if a piano could rise into the air. I have seen the ones under bridges, the forms they make of sleep. I could go on this way until the end of the page, even though what I have in my mind isn't the thing itself, but the category of belief that sees the thing as a shelter for what is beneath it. There is no shelter. You cannot put a tarp over a wave. You cannot put a tarp over a war. You cannot put a tarp over the broken oil well miles under the ocean. There is no tarp for that raging figure in the mind that sits in a corner and shreds receipts and newspapers. There is no tarp for dread, whose only recourse is language so approximate it hardly means what it means. He is not here. She is sick. She cannot remember her name. He is old. He is ashamed.
I remember first reading this poem and having to stop for a minute. I was so struck by it and so surprised by the place it takes you to and the effect that it manages to have with these simple sentences and utterly normal language at the end.
Yeah.
And somehow it's devastating.
It's surprising. You know, it talks very prosaically about tarps, which in itself is quite a feat. I mean, where I grew up, people had tarps everywhere. It was really no big deal. But so you get the beautiful kind of evocation of the way these things look. But then it ups the ante in the middle of the poem where it gets into a philosophical mode.
I could go on this way until the end of the page, even though what I have in my mind isn't the thing itself, but the category of belief that sees the thing as a shelter for what is beneath it. There is no shelter.
That's really arresting. You cannot put a tarp over a wave. You cannot put a tarp over a war, and so on. And then once you get adjusted to that arresting change in the poem, the ending is completely astonishing. Mm. In fact, in the last two stanzas, which are introduced by the words, there is no tarp for dread, the word tarp is gone from the poem forever.
Yeah.
It doesn't come back. You would expect this to be a litany, tarp, 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 you know, but it surpasses that expectation.
Yeah, and it's the way that those images, which threaten to become poetic at the beginning.
Another flew off the back of a truck, black as a piano, if a piano could rise into the air.
If that's all the poem was, you'd say, all right, that's a little precious and delicate. And the poem then says, you know, I could keep doing this forever, making these images.
The one I liked was Catching the Rain of Olives as They Fell. That's just gorgeous. And you just imagine the poem is going to go on like that, you know, all the way through.
Yeah.
But it's too smart for that.
Yeah. Suddenly it jerks itself into place, and it jerks your mind into place. Let's hear another poem by Rick Barrett.
This poem's title is On Gardens, and the little backstory that I can tell about this poem is that I was born in the Philippines and immigrated to the United States when I was about 10. And one of the jokes that you often hear among Filipinos is, in the blood of every Filipino is the drop of blood from a Spanish friar. And it has to do with the Philippines having been a colony of Spain for over 300 years. And the fact that the priests and friars who were there from Spain often raped the women of the country.
The poem also refers to the garden of Vida Sackville West, the writer and lover of Virginia Woolf. Part of this famous garden grows only white flowers.
It's a stunningly beautiful place, but the racial implications of a white-only garden struck me when I visited it. I love the garden, but I had to write a fuck you poem against it.
And here is that poem.
On Gardens. When I read about the garden designed to bloom only white flowers, I think about the Spanish friar who saw one of my grandmothers 200 years removed and fucked her. If you look at the word colony far enough, you see it traveling back to the Latin of inhabit, till, and cultivate. Words that would have meant something to the friar, walking among the village girls as though in a field of flowers, knowing that fucking was one way of having a foreign policy. As I write this, there's snow falling, which means that every angry thought is as short-lived as a match. The night is its own white garden. Snow on the fence, snow on the tree stump, snow on the azalea bushes, their leaves hanging down like green bats from the branches. I know it's not fair to see qualities of injustice in the aesthetics of a garden, but somewhere between what the eye sees and what the mind thinks is the world. Landscapes mangled into sentences, one color red into rage. When the neighbors complained the roots of our cypress were buckling their lot, my landlord cut the tree down. I didn't know a living thing 3 stories high could be so silent until it was gone. Suddenly, that sky. Suddenly, all the light in the windows, as though every sheet of glass was having a migraine. When I think about that grandmother, whose name I don't even know, I think of what it would mean to make a garden that blooms black. Peonies and gladiolas of deepest purple. Tulips like ravens. Or a garden that doesn't bloom at all. Rocks poised on clean gravel. When the snow stops, I walk to see the quiet that has colonized everything. The main street is asleep, except for the bus that goes by, bright as a cruise ship. There are sheet cakes of snow on top of cars. In front of houses, each lawn is as clean as paper, except where the first cat or raccoon has walked across. Each track like a barbed wire sash on a white gown.
Well, again, we have that missing tree, like in the earlier poem, right? In that beautiful image, as though every sheet of glass was having a migraine. It's a shocking line. And again, as in the earlier Rick Barrett poem, we have a poem that interrogates, is the fashionable word now, but interrogates its own ability to describe what it's focusing on and its own right to exist.
I know it's not fair to see qualities of injustice in the aesthetics of a garden. But somewhere between what the eye sees and what the mind thinks is the world.
So it's a very self-conscious poem in that way.
Yes, it's particularly self-conscious when it comes to the words that it's made out of. You know, what's so striking is that I think, again, in poems it's very easy to do a certain thing where if you take on gardens, you know, you'd write about flowers and profusion and, you know, all kinds of florid things. But really, and I never honestly thought much about this till I read the poem, a garden contains many things. Some things quite at odds with each other, but certainly, you know, it's contrary to have a garden that grows only white stuff. I mean, that's not what a garden really is. A garden has everything in it. It has weeds that get in, there are different kinds of plants, there's animals and bugs, and actually a garden has a little bit of everything in it, even though it's cultivated, even if it is inhabited, even if it's tilled. In other words, there's a struggle involved in a garden. But I like the way this poem takes that for granted, that it poses a kind of manipulation that you can have in a garden with what a garden really contains. After all, at least the biblical story is that the garden is like the paradise from which all else kind of descends and is named. So it's very subtle, but that friar, you know, even there, the religious part is hovering in the background with that there is no Eden here. Instead, there are living things that are cut down and are silenced
Yeah, I'm interested in what the writing of the poem or the act of writing, how it is implicated in the whole action here.
Each lawn is as clean as paper, except where the first cat or raccoon has walked across.
Obviously, each pen mark, or if you're still writing with a pen.
Each track, like a barbed wire sash on a white gown.
So that's an image of hostility.
Yeah.
I mean, you think that this writing is rescuing this person, but in fact, the poet seems to be impugning himself in some way or implicating himself in some way. And I think part of it has to do with the lines, "I know it's not fair to see qualities of injustice in the aesthetics of a garden." He knows that it's not the truth that he's ferreting out here. Mm-hmm. It's a different kind of experience, a different kind of truth. And he's part of, well, he uses the word mangled. He's part of that mangling.
Well, you know, even there too, there's something very understated. It's not fair, as you say, to hold this garden against itself. But what really isn't fair is what he knows has happened in history. That's what's not fair. I mean, in a way, aesthetics have very little to do with it. And yet he's so good at the aesthetic part. It's like, well, this is what the poet has to offer as a counterpoint or counterbalance to these other forces against which he's helpless and has to inherit them.
Yeah. Did you notice that when the neighbors complained the roots of our cypress were buckling, how close that buckling is to fucking?
Or unbuckling. Or,
right. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And then the buckling, again, I was thinking of that last line, you know, each track like a barbed wire sash on a white gown, the image of violation there. It isn't pure. It's violated.
And his indignation is not pure.
Right.
He doesn't get to feel self-righteous, which is the strength of the poem.
Yeah, it's a fantastic model of restraint.
Angles of Ascent, a Norton anthology of contemporary African-American poetry, was published this past February. It's edited by Charles Henry Rowell, the editor of the cultural journal Callaloo, and it focuses on post-1960s poetry.
It features the work of many poets who've appeared in Poetry Magazine over the years: Rita Dove, Elizabeth Alexander, Yusuf Kumanyaka, Kevin Young, Terrence Hayes, and many others.
It is reviewed in the May issue by Amiri Baraka, another poetry contributor, who, among many achievements in poetry and fiction, helped found the Black Arts Movement in the mid-1960s.
Amiri Baraka joins us by phone from his home in Newark, New Jersey.
Hi, Amiri.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good. You know, in 1966, you were invited, as you write in your piece, you were invited to Fisk University by Nikki Giovanni. Can you tell us just a little bit about the dispute you got into there with Robert Hayden and Charles Rowell, who edits this new anthology? What was that all about?
Nikki was a student at Fisk then, and she invited me down there right after, I guess, the Black Arts Movement had sort of emerged. At this particular gathering, was Charles Rowell, there was Sister Gwendolyn Brooks, and some other folk down there. We were talking about poetry and the social conflicts in the United States. And I know the poet, what's his name, said, "I'm a poet first and black second."
All right, Robert Hayden.
Robert Hayden said that, and he's sort of Rowell's great mentor. He said that, and I disagreed. I said, "Oh, how could that be possible?" It was a fundamental kind of disagreement on what the Black Arts Movement had been saying, that black poets had to first embrace the struggle of black people for equality and self-determination, and that their poetry should serve in that effort, not only as a more authentic relationship to poetry, that is, a black person writing poetry, but it is also a more important relationship, that is actually using art to forward and intensify the struggle at a higher level. We argued about that, and of course I think Rao has internalized that argument all these years, and so in this anthology he edited, it's like to me a fraudulent attempt to downgrade the poets who are outspokenly in support of the Black Arts Movement or reflected its values, whether they trumpeted that name and title or not. So that's what it is.
Mm. Talk for a moment about the goals and aspirations of the Black Arts Movement and the impact it's had.
Well, the core people at the beginning were living in the village, as I was living in the village, was Malcolm X's murder. Although we had started meeting in the village, you know, black poets, how can we be more relevant to the struggle? You know, suddenly this Sunday afternoon, I was at this book party downtown, and a friend of mine comes running in saying, they just killed Malcolm. That revelation shocked us into recognition that we should be elsewhere, that being in the village, being a poet, et cetera, was not sufficient in that struggle. And as a matter of fact, the next month, a bunch of us had moved to Harlem. I had rented a brownstone, and we had begun to shape the Black Arts Movement. What we did in that first year, 65, was actually begin to take four trucks every day out into the street. One had paintings and easels, so we could set that up on the street. One was a truck where poets would read. One was a truck we did plays. One was a truck we did music. And we moved those to places all around the village, you know, play streets, dead ends, anywhere we could set up and perform. That had a tremendous influence on black writers throughout the country. Black arts theaters began to open in Detroit, Cleveland. There's a movement in Chicago, there's a movement in D.C., New Orleans, Oakland, California. So it started to pick up. And that overwhelming message coming out of this is that we poets, we artists must be political. We must enlist. If we are going to be artists, we should make that art relevant to the struggles of the Afro-American people for self-determination and for equal rights in America.
I wonder, what effect do you think the Black Arts Movement has had on poets' writing today? Has that shock lasted into this moment?
No, because every good deed you do is rewarded by a bad deed. So that the co-optation of black artists followed the whole Black Arts Movement and actually transformed a lot of those folks into, you know, waiting to get into the mainstream types, you know, which is what it is now today.
Well, let me ask you one last question. There's a young poet that we've published a bit of in Poetry Magazine. He's quite young. I think he may be 30 years old. His name is Reginald Dwayne Betts, and he came to poetry in prison. He was in prison he was part of a carjacking, actually, when he was very young and spent some time in prison. Somebody gave him an anthology in prison, and he found himself turning to poetry, and he's become quite a good poet, we think. We've published a number of his poems and given him a Ruth Lilly Fellowship. I wonder how you would respond to something that he said. Reginald says that he wants to be seen as a poet first and not necessarily as a black poet, which is essentially the same thing that Robert Hayden was saying all those years ago. How do you respond to someone who's 30 years old saying this now?
Well, that means he hasn't been paying attention. I mean, you can begin with Langston Hughes arguing with County Cullen back in the 20s, not to mention, you know, the struggle in the 60s between ourselves and those Negro poets who wanted to be seen as poets only, or they didn't want to be. And that's the way County Cullen says. He didn't want to be a Negro poet. But he'd be a Negro, he'd be black, whether he was a poet or not. The question is, do you use that culture, history, the emotional development for your poetry, or do you dismiss it? And we all have, in a largely white society, we also have that kind of a dichotomous attitude, like Du Bois said, double consciousness, to see yourself always through the eyes of people that hate you. It's something that you have to grasp and step over, get around. There's nothing wrong with you being black. It's just like there's nothing wrong with you being white. It's what you do with it that matters, you know.
Well, Amiri, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
You can read Amiri Baraka's review and everything else you heard on this program in the May 2013 issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox with help from Posey Gruner.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scherer.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.